This is The End User, episode 143 for Tuesday, August 13th. Hyperloop for dogs. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, welcome back. You were gone last week.
That's right.
So was I, but you were more gone than I was.
That's right. And we, you can't avoid traveling sometimes.
All right. Well, let me catch you up on what you missed. The worst kept secret in tech, as I've seen it called on many blogs, the Motorola X was announced.
So it's official now, because I know we've wanted to talk about this thing in the past, and we thought, well, you know, we'll wait for the actual announcement.
Yeah, it's probably a good thing we did, because a lot of people sort of didn't get it exactly right. It's it's sort of a budget phone.
Sort of. I'm not sure I'd call it a budget phone. It's just not highest.
It's got high-end specs, but it's not an iPhone killer. They're calling it the anti-iPhone.
Right, the anti-iPhone, which that's a bit of a strange way to put it. But, you know, I guess it does embody some of the opposite ideas of the iPhone. But I don't know. I mean, aren't we at a point now where we can kind of put that to rest? These phones are large slabs of glass that have software on them. And the software is the more important part than the hardware at this point, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, the hardware is minor variations on a theme, especially when it comes to Android phones. They're all nearly identical on the outside, and they're all running Android on the inside. It's just a question of how it's implemented.
I don't know. That HTC One, it's got something special.
Well, I haven't seen the HTC One yet, but I have seen a couple of Galaxy S4s, and I've played with a few of them, and they're actually pretty great.
Yeah, it's a nice little phone from what I can see.
Oh, it's not little. That's one thing it is not.
That's true. The further we go into the future with Android phones, the more ping pong paddle they get.
Someone should just design a phone that's actually a ping pong paddle.
That would be great. Then I wouldn't need to take my ping pong paddle to the ping pong bar. Actually, you know, I would have a lot of fun playing ping pong with a Galaxy Note 2 or something like that. That would be an awesome time. You know, both people have a Galaxy Note. That would be awesome.
Well, okay. So let's go over some of the specs for the Moto X.
So one of the things that people are a little bit upset about, it looks like, is the 4.7-inch 720p AMOLED screen. So I don't know. That's fine for me. I mean, do we really need 1080p screens on phones?
No, not at the sizes they're currently at, because even at 5 inches, if you have a 1080p screen, that's 440 pixels per inch, which is way above the limit that the human eye can detect.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't see that as a big deal. What I'd be more concerned about is the quality of the screen, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
The reports are that the screen is a little, you know, oversaturated because AMOLED screens just kind of exaggerate colors and the like. So that's been one kind of objection. And we're going to get it sometime in September. It's going to be the usual $199 with a 2-year contract here in the States. And it looks like a downright competent phone. I mean, it's not terribly exciting, but it's the latest version of Android. It's nearly stock. There's a couple apps that they add on, and I think it looks like a great device to me. So one of its features that actually does stand out a little bit is they have these swappable backs, which are kind of neat. So you get to pick the color of the back and the volume rockers. And, you know, it's not like the old Nokia candy bar phones where you can snap the back off. I mean, I guess you can, but what's kind of cool is that you can order it and specify the colors up front, and you can they have the Moto Make website that you can use to customize the thing. So you can even give them your Google account, and it'll come already signed in. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. And one of the reasons that Motorola can do this and offer so many colors and options for American purchasers right now is that it's hand-assembled in a plant in Fort Worth, Texas.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So it's not the overseas from China thing. I'm sure all the parts are, but the final assembly is in Texas. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, more than 50 colors available.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. I think when we start to get into a market that is mature, this is the kind of thing that sets you off. And I think we're definitely into a mature smartphone market. You know, smartphones just aren't as exciting as they used to be. And I don't think they ever will be again.
Yeah, probably not. But it's tough to say.
Yeah, so I'm. This is cool.
Letting yeah, but you... the Made in America thing, the colors thing, I think those are pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely so. So I'm looking forward to... I got to get one of these in my hand and see what that's like. You know, I love my Windows phone, but Android's looking better and better by the day.
One other thing that I want to mention about it is that the back has... It's pretty drastically curved. You know, it's got more of a curve than most Android phones have had recently. I haven't seen a curved phone like this since the iPhone 3G.
Yeah, and what was that? Do you remember a while ago they had all of these curved touchscreens? Do you remember? That didn't really take off, I guess, but... that was a thing for a while back there.
Oh, yeah, sure. Like, I think the...
One of the Nexus devices had it.
Yeah, the Nexus 1, maybe? Maybe it was the original Galaxy Nexus? It had an inverse curve, or a concave screen curve on the front of the device. So the glass itself was curved. And the idea was they were making this phone so big that it needed to curve to fit your face. And some people like it, some people didn't. But I think having a curved back of the device and a flat front is more ergonomical.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that was ultimately a silly aside. And, you know, I know when you say something like that, somebody is going to come out of the woodwork and say, oh, you know, I loved the curved screen. But
well, that's why I said some people like it.
Yes, exactly right. But I think that was ultimately a silly aside. But
well, you're allowed to have that opinion because I've covered our
bases. You've covered our grounds. Yeah.
All right. Well, there is another new highly anticipated flagship phone, and that is LG's new G2. We don't know as much about this one. We sure know plenty about it, though. It comes with the quad-core Snapdragon S4 Pro. And it uses a Snapdragon 800 system on a chip with the S4 Pro processor. And the new feature here is that it's got buttons on the back to let you control it.
Yeah, that kind of seems natural, doesn't it? I mean, you wrap your fingers around your phone like this. It only seems natural to put some buttons where your fingers naturally rest.
Right. It's where your fingers are. Why not?
Yeah, so that kind of makes sense. This one, to the opposite of the Nexus we just talked about, is the high-end device, right? This is a 1080p IPS display on a 5.2-inch phone.
Absolutely, yeah. 5.2 inches. It's pretty darn big.
So if you take a look...
It's definitely got the highest specs. You know, it's got a non-removable battery. It's much thinner than the Moto X, this is definitely going to be a very high-end phone.
Yeah, and if you take a look at the picture in the show notes here, we've got an article from Ars Technica. They've got a photo of them announcing it on stage, and I believe that device is actually life-size there. So it's... you know, what do we say, five inches? It's not actually 5 inches. It's like 15 feet tall. That's where Android phones will end up, I think.
Oh, good. I was worried this Qualcomm executive was only 6 inches tall.
That's great. So, yeah, the upshot on this phone is it's the highest end. And again, I think we're at a point where you can say, okay, we've got 1080p. It's somewhere around 5 inches. And, you know, the chip is fast enough, you can play all your games and whatnot, and that's kind of the end of it. And then the rest of it is, what is Android doing? And I think Android is looking a lot better recently than it has in the past, and I think we've got a nice-looking phone here.
Yeah, I think we do. I'm going to reserve judgment on it until we get some full test reviews. We've only had a few hands-on here so far.
This 13-megapixel camera is a bit disappointing to me after seeing the 42-megapixel camera from Nokia.
Well, Nokia is still kind of cornering the market on those 40-plus megapixel phones.
Yeah.
So 13 is just fine to me. It sounds okay.
Yeah, in fact, even 13 is a little overkill. But yeah, I guess they're the only ones that have that insane megapixel camera. It's crazy.
Yeah. All right, well, there isn't much more to say about the LG G2, but we'll know more when we get the full review.
And we do. And one more bit about Android. They've also announced the... it's called the Android Device Manager, and it's basically an app that allows you to do remote wipes of the phone and that kind of thing. Kind of like your Find My iPhone, I'm sure you're familiar with, Taylor.
Yeah, Find My iPhone is really great, and it's getting better with every iteration of iOS. And whenever I come across someone who has an iPhone and doesn't have an iCloud account with Find My iPhone enabled, I harass them until they enable it. and so the fact that Android users will have this same capability is really great. It's been fantastic to me and a lot of people that I know in finding your phone just anytime you lose it for any reason, whether it's missing in your house or whether somebody stole it or you don't know which is which.
Yeah, and Windows Phone also has this feature. In fact, I kind of forgot that it did. But Android is the last one to the game here with this first-party solution, at least. You know, there's always been apps that will locate and wipe your phone, like Lookout or whatever. But I always prefer, if there is a first-party option, to use the first-party option. And that's what
Yeah, exactly. You don't want it to be a third-party app that somebody who steals your phone can just come in and delete. You want it to be built in. You want it to be difficult for them to circumvent.
So the other thing that I think is interesting is this thing will scan your phone for suspicious applications that are installed. So we're starting to see a little bit of the antivirus creep into a first-party app from Google on Android. And I think that's kind of interesting. You know, it's got all these features, but I think seeing some kind of notion of antivirus leak into Android is definitely a good thing.
Absolutely. And with the open nature of the Google Play Store, it's really high time that they had something like that as well.
Yeah, definitely so. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. It's like what Microsoft did with Windows when they included their own antivirus in Windows 8 for the first time. So, you know, they always had security essentials around on Windows 7, but 8 is the first time they included it, you know, right with the operating system. And, you know, it really makes for the best user experience. So I'm glad to see Android get some notion of antivirus.
Right.
Or at least app scanning. I mean, antivirus may be overreaching a little.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the framework for an antivirus system, a first-party antivirus system. You know, it reminds me a lot of Microsoft Security Essentials.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right.
All right. Well, our next story is about Netflix. They have delivered individual account profiles, up to 5 of them per account. And I've already tried this out. They've implemented it on the Apple TV. It's really easy. You can actually set it up right from Apple TV or from, I would assume, just about any device. If they already have it for Apple TV, I would be surprised if it's not just about everywhere already. But it's pretty nice. You know, if you have more than one person who watches Netflix and they have different tastes, like we do in my house, it's great. There's a little bit of a learning curve, but it's good to have. The only problem is there is a very limited selection of profile icons. You can't add your own pictures. You have to choose from these multicolor but only two-tone weird little icon things. There is a woman with an eye patch, some sort of geometric bird figure, and a Picasso-like smiley face, and some other ones. Those are the only three that I've seen.
Yeah, from what I can see, now I haven't gotten a chance to check it out yet, but from what I can see, I mean, this is just a huge win for most people using Netflix. This is something that people have wanted for a very long time, and it's something that I'm frankly surprised they didn't do earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it wasn't very hard to get by without it. even with there are five people in my house and we all have different Netflix watching tastes. But it's nice to have, and yeah. It makes things easier.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess it was just a low priority.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, so I am looking to use my Windows Media Center with this, and I can't. So your assumption about where this is available and where this is not available falls short, at least for me.
I am sure you will figure out a way to implement it. You know, you'll work your way around it. You'll find a hack.
So it at least it
I
doesn't
believe in you.
At least it doesn't completely hose the Media Center Netflix plugin. So if you just leave it with one user account, then the plugin will still work. So at least it didn't completely hose everything.
Oh, but if you try to make accounts somewhere else, it'll break it?
Yeah, so if you add accounts to your Netflix, the plugin will just kind of barf and not work for you.
Oh, well, that's too bad. Well, hopefully they'll update it soon.
Yeah. So I'll be, well, I wouldn't hold my breath for them updating the Netflix plugin. I think they're in a mode where if there is a serious bug, they'll fix it. And if it's something like this, then okay, they'll probably not do a whole lot about it.
Yeah. Apparently, they are also not yet on Android or the Nintendo Wii. Those are coming later.
Yeah, so I'm glad to see this feature roll out. And, they'll get all the platforms as we go by here.
Apple TV had it right away. It was great.
Yeah, it's cool. I wonder if that was their testing platform or something while they were building it.
Could be. I don't know. All right, so our last top story this week is something that I think we mentioned briefly in passing in an earlier episode. But Elon Musk, one of the co-founders of eBay and currently the CEO of SpaceX and Tesla Motors, which we have talked about before, he has released basically open source plans for a new form of high-speed transportation called Hyperloop. And it has a theoretical top speed of 760 miles per hour. It's much faster and cheaper than conventional trains. And what it basically does, you would build an enclosed tube on elevated tracks and then use compressors at either end to pump out the air and create a partial vacuum. And then the trains themselves will float on jets of compressed air through the vacuum and accelerate quickly up to 760 miles an hour. The way he's designed this train is that they would have very small trains that are only wide enough for two people side by side, and each car would only carry about 28 passengers or so. So his plan, if hypothetically it was built between Los Angeles and San Francisco, as these designs call for, would be that it would leave one car would leave every 30 seconds to 2 minutes. And so you wouldn't have to make reservations. You wouldn't have to worry about it. You would just head to the Hyperloop station and hop on the next available train.
Cool. I mean, that sounds fantastic. The thing that I think is kind of outstanding is, well, who is going to make this, where and how is
exactly.
that going to work?
It's not outstanding enough that Elon Musk wants to make it himself. He is adamant that it will cost much less than the planned high-speed maglev train that right. they want to build in California. It would only cost about $6 billion for the LA-San Francisco route, which is a lot less than it would cost to build the maglev train. But even though he has a great deal of that in personal wealth, he is not planning to be personally involved with this, which is why he's released these designs as open source.
Right. So he's saying, you know, here's the idea, and I'd assume he's trying to get some feedback. You know, what's going on here? What do you guys think? You know, is this possible? Can we build this? Is it going to be, what did you say, $6
billion? $6 billion, yeah.
I can nearly guarantee you it will be double that or something.
Well, even double that is much cheaper than a lot of existing options.
Yeah, so this is pretty cool looking. Of course, the renders always look futuristic, right?
Right. But I have to imagine, like, the sitting in one of these things would be incredibly futuristic. I can hardly even imagine how awesome it is.
Yeah, so do we know how fast this accelerates?
It accelerates so quickly that they need to artificially limit its acceleration for comfort, for passenger comfort.
Right, because you'll get squished against the wall like a bug if they go too quickly.
Right, well, you'd be squished against your seat, but they are going to develop different induction zones that will accelerate at different rates based on how fast it's going and how fast it needs to go, up to a hypothetical maximum of 840 miles per hour.
Yeah, so I got to wonder, you know, there's kind of this idea in space travel where you travel 95% of the journey in 10% of the time, and the rest of the time is spent accelerating and decelerating. So I wonder if we've got some smaller scale notion of the same kind of thing.
No, not really. They actually have a chart of the speeds that the train would go, and it shows velocity and acceleration and what's needed for passenger comfort. But it's able to accelerate fairly quickly in stages and then decelerate fairly quickly as well. With space travel, you're talking about 760,000 to 760 million miles per hour as opposed to just 760 miles per hour.
Well, that's what I mean. It's some notion of the same idea, but not nearly on the scale as space travel.
Yeah. Now, there are obviously technical breakdown concerns to worry about, and the plans address those, but I'm not going to get into them here. They're fairly technical, and it's only 48 page. There's a 48 page summary on the Tesla Motors website. Oh, I'm sorry, 56 pages, you can read about it there via the link in our show notes.
So my favorite tweet, and I can't remember for the life of me who tweeted this, but they said Elon Musk today revealed that he has invented a shotgun for humans.
it's more of a railgun than a shotgun.
A railgun,
sure,
for humans.
Yeah.
I like it.
Uh-huh.
So that seems really cool. I can't wait for this to actually become a reality, if it does indeed become a reality. I don't know. We'll have to see what everyone thinks about it to see whether or not it's actually going to be implemented or not. And, I could see this not going in the United States at first or something like that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Somebody may beat us to the punch.
Yeah, because he says, okay, here's the schematics, and then and then everybody goes around and says, oh, no, you know, not in the United States. We can't do that here. We can't. And then all of a sudden, you know, Japan's got their own because they're pretty technologically adept as well. So I could see that kind of thing happening. That would also be cool as long as humans get to use it.
Who else would use it?
Dogs, perhaps?
Mm, yeah. Well, I would be on board with a dog-only Hyperloop.
Yeah, you can't go with the dog. You just have to put the dog into the Hyperloop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, dogs really hate air travel, so it makes sense.
I can't imagine they would like the human railgun experience either.
You don't know that.
Well, I guess we'll have to find out.
I can't imagine who wouldn't like this. It just seems too awesome.
Cool. All right. Well,
even dogs know awesome.
Well, with that, should we turn on our afterburners? Do you have your seatbelt on?
They're not afterburners anymore, Chris. They're Hyperloops.
They're hyperburners.
Yeah, and no seatbelt is required in the Hyperloop. No, I'm just kidding. We'll keep the afterburners for now. I don't want to pay $6 billion anyway.
Yeah, and you don't want to... I'm sure that title is trademarked at this point, too.
Right.
So I'm not sure we can use it.
Afterburners on. Let's go.
Let's go.
We've talked about the Oculus Rift before, the fully immersive 3D headset that tracks the motion of your head to give you an immersive virtual reality experience. And now another company called Virtuix has developed an omnidirectional treadmill that would allow you to simulate the experience of walking in whatever direction you choose. So let's see. We've got virtual reality sight. We've got virtual reality walking. We've got virtual reality surround sound headphones. So that's what, like three of the five senses, four if you can't smell a vision. We just need taste, and then we'll have a holodeck, right?
I suppose so. You know, or you could just go outside. There's always that.
Ah, yes, the original virtual reality.
The original virtual reality. Reality.
Right. The graphics I hear are amazing.
Yeah, it's almost like real life. So HP has unveiled some details about one of its newest devices called the SlateBook PC, and it's a kind of Windows 8-style convertible laptop, and it's actually running Android, which is what makes this very interesting. So no Windows 8 here. It's a 10.1-inch screen. It's 1920 by 1200 resolution there, and it looks kind of cool. I'm kind of excited to see where we can go with these kind of mobile operating system laptops, and if that is indeed enough for people to use. So I think that's quite interesting. So it's going to be about $480 when it does come out.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited. Facebook has finally switched all of its users over to secure HTTP. That's where you see HTTPS in the beginning of your browser address bar, although whose browser still has the HTTP in there? But this is great. This also, I noticed this week, has prevented most users and sites from unsecured access to Facebook photos.
Yeah, so if you remember way back when, we had that Firefox plugin called FireSheep, which allowed you to steal credentials on the local network, say at Starbucks or something like that. And the way to mitigate that is over HTTPS. And
right, that was one of our first the end user public service announcements.
Right, so you've been able to for a long time now turn on HTTPS in the settings of Facebook, but now it's on by default for all users. So I think that is definitely the right move, and I'm glad to see it.
Awesome.
So Feedly has announced that they're going to have some pro tier for $5 a month. That'll get you HTTPS, some enhanced search, and some premium features to be named later, basically. And so they have a limited rollout for 5,000 people. So all of those slots are already gone. But I've got to imagine that this is a pilot for a larger market to see if there's interest in a Feedly premium service. So,
yeah, and it seems like the interest was there, so they say they're going to launch it in just a couple of weeks.
Right, so I'm looking forward to see what that looks like.
Yeah, me too. All right, an unnamed corporate entity has decided to revive the old Reader. This is the Google Reader alternative that has some of the old social media features that Google had moved before it closed them, and they announced that they would be closing because they didn't have the user base and they didn't have a profitable model. But I guess some unnamed company has stepped in to keep the old Reader open.
Taylor, I'm going to start a band and call it Unnamed Corporate Entity.
I'm pretty sure you would get sued by an unnamed corporate entity.
Right, by all of the unnamed corporate entities. I like that. That's cool.
Yeah.
So in kind of a surprise move, it looks like the Washington Post was sold to Jeff Bezos, who we know as the founder of Amazon. So this is quite interesting. We don't quite know why Jeff Bezos was interested in the Washington Post, but it's a $250 million cash deal for the Washington Post. And as we know, newspapers are having some trouble these days with a sustainable business model. And, it can't hurt the Washington Post to have a backer like Jeff Bezos around. But, it's not Amazon. It's Jeff Bezos. So I'm not sure what he's going to do with this. If Amazon had bought them, I could imagine some Kindle integration or something like that. But I'm not sure what Jeff Bezos is up to.
Yeah, he bought it as an individual person, not as an unnamed corporate entity. And not as Amazon.
Right.
So he can integrate it with Kindle more than it already is, or he can choose not to. He hasn't made any plans. He did write an excellent open letter to the employees of the Post, but he's also stated that he really has no roadmap for where he's going with the ownership of the newspaper.
Yeah, it just happened. He has no idea what he's doing yet.
I'm sure he has an idea what he's doing, Chris.
No idea what he wants to do, I guess.
All right, Apple has a new program where they will replace your third-party USB power adapters. They sell them for $19, but you can get an official Apple replacement if you trade in your third-party adapter for $10. Now, lots of people have these USB power adapters all over the place. Some people even have USB chargers built into the walls. I think that's really awesome. But if you are getting by on a really terrible power adapter and you were thinking about upgrading anyway, this is a really great way to do it, because I've seen some teardowns of these Apple adapters, and they are not only one of the smallest available, but also the most well constructed. It's incredibly over engineered. Even $19 is a halfway decent value. $10 if you need a USB adapter is a really great one. I just wanted to throw that out there. Most people probably don't need it. If you have one from a any reputable company, the one that came with your phone or your Kindle or your Nexus 7 is going to be fine. But if you bought one from a sketchy eBay auction or something, then I would maybe think about getting an official Apple one, even if you don't have an Apple device, because they are they're very well designed and they will last.
Going in lockstep with that for a second, there was also a software Trojan for the hardware charger that was exploiting some iPhones. So this was at one of the hacker conventions that was around recently. So you can't quite just plug your iPhone into any old charger now. You got to be a little careful.
Yeah, and so getting an official Apple one, again, even if you're not going to use it for an Apple product.
And Twitter has rolled out their two-factor authentication scheme, and they've decided to kind of roll their own. They're not using the standard that a lot of other companies use. But two-factor authentication on any web application is always a good thing. So it's good to see them roll that out.
And the nice thing is that you can do this from any of their mobile apps as well. You don't have to go to the web or to a computer to enable it.
Right, so that's definitely a good thing. And if you if you're not using two-factor, it's time to at least start to consider it.
Yeah, and if you are a serious Twitterer, or if for some reason you still share your Twitter password with other apps, you definitely want to do this.
All right, and that will do it for the Afterburners. So, Taylor, you can relax, you can take off your seatbelt, and pour yourself a gin fizz.
That a gin fizz takes like 2 minutes to make. I'd have to get the egg whites out. All right, Chris, we're gonna take a break. Yeah. I'm gonna go make a gin fizz.
Yeah, we'll stay here.
I'll be back in 3.5 minutes with tired arms.
Yeah, and you got to go to the store and everything. So, all right, let's get into some Windows Phone news. I thought this was kind of insane. Microsoft announced a web app that you can use to kind of get yourself started with Windows Phone development. So I was able to give this thing a try, and it's really neat. You sign in with your Live account, and they've got this interface where you can drag and drop components onto the screen. And then once you're all done with everything that you can do on the web, because you know it's not a full programming environment, you have to if you want to do a little bit more, you have to import it and write some code, right? But what's really neat is once you're done building this application on the little website, you can actually download the solution and move over to actually writing some code and all of the stuff that you would associate with normally writing an app. So it seems like a really good way for people to get started with Windows Phone development.
Yeah, we've definitely seen some third-party applications that try to make app development this simple, both for Windows Phone and for Android. There are even a few for iOS, although you still have to go through a much more complicated process because of the vetted App Store nature of iOS. But this is, I think, the first one that we've seen a simple, relatively code-free first-party app development process, which is pretty cool.
See, and then, you know, I don't want to get off into the developer's corner too much, but what's really neat is that, so if you don't know how to code at all, you can go use this thing and do some very simple stuff. But what's really cool is that once you're done, you can actually take it and write some code behind it. And that just seems like a great idea. You know, you can kind of get started and flesh out your idea. And then when you're actually ready to get down and learn some code, then you can go and do that. So that seems like a really cool way of doing things. So one more thing here. There is some magic involved. And it's really cool. So you make this little app, and you just drag and drop. And when you're done, it says you can download the solution here, and they give you a link, and you can download the source code to the app that they've generated for you. And what's really cool is they also put a barcode on the screen, and you can just scan the barcode, and it'll install the app on your phone.
Oh, that is really cool.
Yeah, a little bit of magic there. So that's really cool. So, you know, I have a little test application on my phone. I couldn't believe how easy that was. That was really neat.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I will definitely check that out next time I see you in person.
Oh, well, there's not much to check out. I just wanted to see, you know, how it worked.
Cool. All right. Well, can I talk about my green tech story of the week?
Yes, let's do. What do you got for us?
All right. This one comes from Cree, the LED light bulb company. Now, we've talked about this before. Cree is bringing very low-cost LED light bulbs to the market. They work for up to 100,000 hours. They are very much cheaper in the long term than incandescents or fluorescents or halogens. But they are moving into a new market space, and that is municipal streetlights. Streetlights are already a little bit more efficient just because of the way they're designed, you know, because there are so many of them and they use so much power in so many cities all around the world. But Cree has managed to totally top conventional streetlights and offer ones that can cut electricity usage by 65 to 75% from sodium streetlights and have a better color temperature as well, particularly for municipal uses. But they are cheap enough, $99 a piece, that you can use them for residential uses if you have a large area that you want to light at night. They are so much more efficient and so much cheaper to operate than traditional sodium streetlights that typical payback is less than 1 year.
I like my color temperature to be warm.
Like really warm? Like streetlight warm?
Yeah, like hot to the touch. Actually, no, I don't want that at all. So I do want a warm color temperature, but I don't want it to be hot to the touch.
Sodium streetlights and these LED bulbs will probably both still be hot to the touch. But that's okay because they're 10 to 20 feet in the air.
Right. So that's really interesting. So, you know, it's fine that some consumers have replaced their bulbs with LEDs, right? But on such a scale as a large city, replacing all of those lights is probably a massive amount of wattage.
Oh, absolutely. It's huge.
So I'd have to imagine that this would be a... while you also want consumers to limit their power consumption by using LED light bulbs, on the scale of a city, it's just a whole other story.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Just over a four-year test program in certain neighborhoods in Los Angeles, the city has been able to save $10 million already. And that was just a pilot program.
Wow. So that's pretty cool. I'd have to imagine we're going to see Cree, as well as other companies, start to come into this space.
Yeah, absolutely. This article that I have here from CNET also mentions other LED streetlight companies as Hadco and Leotech, who I've never heard of before.
Yeah, so as a consumer, you probably won't hear a whole lot about it, but that transformation will silently take place over time, I'd imagine.
But isn't it interesting that these are so cheap and efficient that if you wanted to light a private outdoor space, you could do so relatively cheaply with these?
You could absolutely. Yeah, if you had like a soccer field or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
I could see this applying in that realm. We also have a tip of the week. What do you got for us here?
We do. This was something that I picked up from Lifehacker, as we often do for our tip of the week. And it's just a simple way to reorganize your home screen. Now, I used to be obsessive about having my home screen organized into folders. I thought about like how I held my phone and where my thumb was and like what I needed to reach the most and like what would be easier to reach and what folders did I want and how do I want to organize the folders. And it's gotten to the point where it's so complicated and I just have so many apps now that it's very difficult for me to even start thinking about how to organize my home screen on my iPhone. So this tip just sort of helps me get started with a method of organization. And you just look at your application switcher. So for iPhones, you know, you just double tap the home button and your little application tray comes in. With Android, there are a bunch of different third-party options that you can use for managing your apps and multitasking. However you manage your apps, just, you know, look at the list of recently used apps and that over time, you know, maybe make a little list and jot stuff down. It'll give you an idea of which apps you use the most and give you a framework for rebuilding your home screen, which I'm going to do this week. That's why I'm sharing it.
So I've got a kind of Windows Phone take on that. They Windows Phone 8 has this Data Sense feature, which can give you a pretty decent idea of how much you use certain things. I mean, obviously it's going to be skewed toward Netflix, but I'm looking at it now, and it gives you a breakdown of what you use on Wi-Fi and cellular and how many gigabytes you use and stuff like that. So that seems like a pretty cool feature. And in the last 30 days, I've used 6 gigs on Wi-Fi and 2.5 on cellular. That's quite a bit.
Wow, yeah, that is quite a bit.
So it may be a little bit of a different take on Windows Phone. But yeah, a great idea.
All right, cool. Yeah, it's as simple as that.
And you also have an app pick for us. What is this?
I do. This is a cross-platform app for OS X, Windows, and Android called cool. AnySend. This sort of mimics AirDrop for OS X, which will work with iOS in iOS 7, but it's only between iDevices and Macs. What it does is it's a simple, virtually interface-free way to share files over Wi-Fi, it's easy, it's intuitive, and it only works with Apple products. So AnySend is the open cross-platform version of that, and I haven't tried it yet because I still only have Apple devices, and so I don't need to, but I use AirDrop a lot, and I would imagine that anyone who has a Windows device or an Android device would also be looking for something like that, and that's why I'm sharing it.
So this is like Dropbox, but on your local network. So do I have that right?
Yeah, sort of. There's no, you know, Dropbox has a single place where it keeps everything for you. This just uses your local network to move things from one device to the other.
Okay. So kind of similar, but it's...
Yeah.
It's not like
there's a permanent... But, I mean, imagine if you tried to upload, like, a multi-gigabyte video file, you know, you'd send it to Dropbox, that would take hours, and then drop it back down, whereas over Wi-Fi, that would take seconds or minutes.
Yeah, you definitely don't want to do that with Dropbox. Not made for large videos and, I don't know, like Blu-ray rips or something.
Right, I mean, and a lot of people, they're using USB drives or they're burning DVDs, or sometimes you can plug in a cable, but then you have to figure out the connections and make sure that everything is working properly. And sometimes you just want to do it simply and you can share it cross-platform. So now you can go from Windows to OS X or to OS X to Android or Android to Windows.
I got to tell you, though, there's something beautiful about having a home server on your network to do this kind of stuff with. It may not be as ad hoc.
I totally agree, Chris, but not simple.
Oh, no, not simple. Yeah, some people just don't want to get into the management of having, you know, and I don't necessarily mean Windows home server, but just some kind of storage device on the network and having the ability to do everything that gives you. But
yes, but what if you're on someone else's network?
Right, right. So, it's some places it doesn't really apply, and there's a case to be made for these kind of ad hoc networks. And even like AirPlay, you know, its counterpart. Forget the files. Just throw the video on the TV. I don't care about files. But in reality,
right, absolutely.
In reality,
that's what something like Google Chromecast is for.
Yes. But in reality, sometimes you just need to, you know, care about files.
Yeah, you just want something that will let you send files from one computer to another without any questions asked.
Cool. All right. Well, let's get into our last story of the week. I've got a very wacky story to share with you.
Yeah, you've got the kicker this week.
For once. Yeah, it's usually
well
not,
done.
Yeah, it's usually not me that finds the kicker, but so there was a pilot program in London, England, where they would embed some electronics inside of the recycling bins that are out on the street. And I guess these recycling bins had some smarts to them, and they could latch on to your Wi-Fi signal and look at your MAC address. And your MAC address is the unique identifier to your phone that identifies your phone as your phone, or in this case with smartphones, since everybody carries them around, identify you as you for the most part. So I guess they were trying to get some idea of, you know, what people were walking around the streets and what the kind of traffic patterns were like. And it kind of sounds like a good idea at first, but then you actually roll it out and, you know, it's actually kind of creepy.
It is a little bit creepy, yeah.
So they also hooked up with some mobile advertising companies to get these things to serve you hyper-local ads. So I don't know. I think they're just kind of experimenting with it, and there was an extremely negative reaction, and they're actually not going to do this anymore.
Yeah, it was canceled after only a few days.
Yeah. And again, you know, I could see being totally just enthusiastic about the technology and say, look at all this great technology we have. And then, you know, you don't really think about the privacy implications and that kind of thing. And this is one of those things where you have to take a step back and look at exactly what you're doing. And it may not be okay to track people's MAC address from their Wi-Fi, which happens to be turned on. Ultimately, it's up to the person to turn your Wi-Fi off if you don't want this kind of thing. But you got to take a step back sometimes and see if people in the real world would be upset by this or not.
Turns out they were.
Yeah, turns out they were. So, but you know, in the end, they did the right thing and turned it off. And now I want to get one of those. It's going to be a vintage item sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm.
This is the London recycling box of 2013.
Totally, yeah. I guess there are only 100 of them. That's probably all there will ever be.
Yeah, it's probably right. It's kind of a collector's item now.
Yeah, it might be.
All right, well, that's a podcast. Shall we get out of here?
Sure.
All right, so if somebody were to contact you, perhaps through a recycling bin, how would they do that?
Well, I think we sort of explained it already, but I'm glad you asked. So you get one of these Renew recycling bins, and then you program it to track my MAC address, and then when I walk by the recycling bin, you serve me an ad directly to my iPhone. That would be a great way to get in contact with me. I would be angry, but I would be contacted nonetheless.
Right. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good way.
Yeah.
Although, you'd have to go to
one. That'd be a great way. I guess they probably ship.
Yeah,
but I guess if you didn't do that, if you couldn't get your hands on one of those recycling bins, you could always send me a message on Twitter. I'm at TaylorPhone, TaylorPhone.
All right, and if you want to get at me, I'm at Chris Hale Barnes. So give us both a follow on Twitter. We'll let us know what you think of the show. You know, together, if you want to just talk to either of us at the show, we are at The End User, so you can always go there and check us out. So thank you everyone for listening to the show, and of course you can find more information including the show notes over at thedigitalmediazone.com under The End User. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts you can have a listen to: Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and Richard Gunther's new home automation podcast called Home On. You can send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or like I mentioned, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at @theenduser. You can join us live in the chat room as we record the show every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And don't forget, leave us a vote on iTunes, Zune, or your podcast portal of choice. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.